Okay, it's my pleasure in the final session of the day to introduce Dr. Amiel Unger, who has a PhD from Columbia in political science. Dr. Unger and his wife moved to the town of Toccoa in 1979, where they currently reside, and he has represented Toccoa on the Etzion Regional Council and the Yesha Council, and is currently on the governing board of Toccoa. Dr. Unger taught political science at Bar-Ilan and Ariel College for 25 years. He was a columnist for Nekuda and has since been the foreign policy columnist for Makor Rishon, political columnist for Besheva. He's contributed foreign policy pieces for Yediot Ahronot, Jerusalem Post, Emunah Magazine. He's been a columnist for the Jerusalem Report since 1996, and he's currently a monthly columnist for Haaretz, the English edition. Please welcome Amiel Unger.
All right, after the third introduction, even I know it by heart. I feel I've been given the kavod of being Baal Shacharit and Nila in this program. The only difference is Nila, the shul, usually fills up. And I think people are experiencing lecture fatigue, so I commend the survivors of the session for sticking it out with me, and I regret that that I'm going to restore us to a bit of pessimism precisely after the Lashana Ba Yerushalayim of Pnina, which I think would have represented a high note and final note, and perhaps in the context of the program, it would have been more appropriate to situate me after the magisterial and programmatic keynote lecture of Professor Erwin Cutler, because we basically touch on similar issues. And basically, while I was an opponent, and I'm still an opponent, it's now easier to be one today, since the majority of Israeli public opinion now regards the Oslo Agreement to have been a mistake, I would like to explain the diplomatic context of the Oslo Agreement. Now, we tend, as the years pass onwards, to forget certain political, diplomatic, cultural contexts that played a role in the decision-making and in the public receptivity to what was basically a leap of faith, something that basically contradicted previous Israeli policy. It was explained as something that was reversible, although, as we know, as opposed to raincoats and jackets, policies are not that easily reversible, particularly since politicians do not like to admit that they had committed an error, something which demands a political price. But I'm going to be somewhat charitable to the protagonists of Oslo, because they were operating in a specific diplomatic context which encouraged them to take that leap of faith. The seminal event preceding the Oslo Agreement was the First Gulf War, what was regarded as a clear-cut, overwhelming victory by the United States against a regime that was, for the sake of the war, considered an epicenter of evil before the axis of evil. Saddam was painted as an incarnation of evil. A resounding clear-cut victory, which, according to the American president, restored the United States to the position that it had occupied prior to the trauma of the Vietnam War. In other words, the war and its success, although there was a very prolonged congressional debate, Senate debate about going to war, something that's forgotten, but in the aftermath of the victory, here was an assertion of Western triumph, an ability to subdue effectively a baddie who threatened world order and was oppressing, invading a weak neighboring country that also had vast deposits of oil. And therefore, this triggered a wave of optimism that we had reached a new world order. That was the stock phrase following the first Gulf War. What had governed international relations during the Cold War? The fact that the United States and the assertion of Western values would be circumscribed by antagonistic forces led by the Soviet Union and in Southeast Asia to a certain extent by the People's Republic of China, that era had terminated and we had reached an era of unipolarism. Not bipolarism, not multipolarism, but unipolarism. That the United States basically could do more or less what it wanted. Witness the Soviet Union in its dying days under Mikhail Gorbachev, after trying vainly to put a spoke into the wheel, basically feebly giving its agreement to Operation Desert Storm, and the People's Republic of China in its period of peaceful rising, and also to take away the sting of the Tiananmen massacre, also acquiescing in the US-led coalition ejecting Saddam from Kuwait. And therefore, to cite Charles Krauthammer, to show that I can also pinion people who I generally agree with and not just people on the other side of the spectrum. Charles Krauthammer said to Israel, relax. This time, the Roman Empire is on your side. That we were entering into a new Pax Romana. That there would be one supervisor who, as Sam and I learned in college, would debolare superbos e parcere subjectis, someone who would demolish the haughty and would be tolerant and genial to those meek and submissive. And here was an opportunity for the state of Israel to bask in this new type of Pax Romana, which had its advantages in the sense that it would provide security. It would also help bypass the internal Israeli debate. While, you know, the idea of saving Israel from itself has its origins with Undersecretary of State George Beall already in the 1960s, the idea that Israel would need a sort of outside push is that was an idea that was shared by some members of the Israeli political elite. In other words, the United States would be the arbiter, a benevolent arbiter, and therefore a solution, a durable solution, could be possible. In one aspect that ties in with Professor Cutler's presentation, one result of this new, seemingly irreversible change in the world order was the one time only that a UN General Assembly resolution was repealed, namely the infamous 1975 resolution equating Zionism with racism. Now, with the apparent shattering of the Third World and the ascendancy of the unipolar system, the festering delegitimation campaign against Israel would be brought to a halt by American fiat. And this action in the United Nations was proof positive that such a thing was possible. Now, when the Gulf War was joined by the collapse of the Soviet Union, we received books, which were once a bestseller, once highly touted as almost axiomatic. We received books like The End of History of Fukuyama, that the idea of international politics based on power politics, based on antagonistic systems, this was passé. We had seen now not only the military triumph of democratic values, Western values, but we had more importantly seen the triumph of Western cultural and democratic values. And therefore, even if there were recalcitrant pockets of resistance to people who, to paraphrase Tom Friedman's book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree. This was before Toyota started recalling cars. The Lexus and the Olive Tree, there were people who would continue to nurture their traditional olive trees. These people were effectively dinosaurs on the verge of extinction. The world was moving from antagonism to a world based on economic relations, to a world based on globalization and economic interdependence. Now, the fact that such theories had been broached before in the 19th century, that wars would now be impossible following the Industrial Revolution and in the increase of international trade, and had been proven wrong, did not cut much ice any more than the ideas that in varied periods that from now on, stock markets could only go upwards. There is a certain cyclical pattern in intellectual thoughts, and just like wide ties and narrow ties, certain ideas are going to come back into style if you hold on to them long enough. But that was the idea, and Shimon Peres expressed it, that a line of hotels would be more effective than a line of fortifications. Because economic interdependence would effectively preclude war. Now, a basic idea inherent in the new thinking and the new world order was, again, the idea of technologies was Bill Clinton, when he urged Congress to support China's application to the World Trade Organization. His most convincing argument was that the fax machine would effectively doom the authoritarian regime in the People's Republic of China, and therefore it was America's ultimate interest to liberalize trade with the People's Republic of China as a handmaiden to ushering the People's Republic of China into a new democratic age. Now, this obviously from the fact that the agreement passed means that the majority of people globally shared that idea, that in a new world of technology and economics and the end of history, all regimes would eventually come to the same outcome. They would be democracies, and democracies do not go to war with each other. Now, here, this is something that I could possibly agree with, that there is less of a chance, although there are cases, and we're going to hopefully see Fort York in the next day or two to show that democracies can go to war with each other. But it's much rarer than something that occurs with autocracies. There was also a sort of post-nationalism attached to the theory of the New World Order, and this brings into focus the other major player on the international scene at this time, with the Soviet Union gone and Russia at first up to 1995 under Yeltsin and Kozyrev, adopting a very pro-Western foreign policy and effectively repudiating the Soviet positions during the Cold War. But the other major factor on the international scene was the European Union. The European Union had major achievements to its credit. You know, again, times change, and people now look upon the European Union somewhat differently, both outside and within the European Union. But the European Union had successfully led to the democratization of countries that had previously experienced prolonged periods of authoritarian rule. Spain is going to the polls today, and we take it for granted that Spain is a democracy, and even a vibrant one. But this was not the case before 1975. Greece, we don't know what's going to happen to Greece, whether it will succumb both economically and what the repercussions will be politically. But the European Union at that time had succeeded in also steering Greece and Portugal, the so-called Mediterranean enlargement. And to take another event that was frequently used as a parallel, a false parallel between Israel and the Israel-Palestinian-Israeli-Arab conflict, the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland, which was again seen as a demonstration that the New World Order, the New Economic Order, was making the old thinking, well, this is in the sense of tautology, the old thinking anachronistic. I apologize for it. For Northern Ireland to share in the European Union's prosperity, to be part, to grab hold of the tail of the Celtic tiger, and it was a tiger, it had best abandoned this dumb, internecine conflict between the prods and the Catholics and get down to business and be part of the new international economic order, and where Britain and the Irish Republic could reach an agreement. Now, this occurred admittedly after the Oslo Agreement, but it fed into the thinking and served as a reinforcement to the idea that nationalist thinking was counterproductive and abandoning these thought patterns would result in a win-win situation under which Gaza would turn into Singapore. This was the idiom being used at the time of the Oslo Agreement. And again, judging from the international context, the supporters of this thesis could point to global developments. Now, the European Union was able to exert soft power. Soft power had replaced the need for hard power. And perhaps to go back to Professor Cutler's address, the idea being that the European Union could impose a set of values on prospective members in return for joining the club. If you wanted to be a member of the European Union success, and for Israel this meant association agreements, trade access, then one had to adopt a certain set of values. But the flip side of it being that if you had adopted certain values, you had adopted certain positions, you were granted a form of an insurance policy that you had paid your dues. You had shown by your positions that you were a worthy member of the club. And then, again, in the words of the progenitors of Oslo, Israel did not require a Hasbara policy. It did not need to rely on its Jewish brethren in the diaspora. The best Hasbara was policy. A policy that would effectively sell itself and would, in a sense, immunize Israel against those forces that Professor Cutler identified in his keynote address. These were the essential assumptions that surrounded Oslo. Obviously, there were other factors. There were internal factors. But I would want to argue that despite the often quoted statement, aphorism by Henry Kissinger that Israel has no foreign policy but only domestic policy, Israelis, I would say at least like Western countries, but I would say even more so, are attentive to what is said about them, what takes place in the international arena, even if they say shmum, they are aware and they don't live in an isolated, insulated world. The question is how to evaluate the benevolence of this world and how much stock to put into the ability of the international order to substitute for Israel's ability to act for itself and take measures for its own defense. Okay, so we have the basic assumptions of the Oslo era, which flourished during the last decade of the 20th century, and what Israeli diplomacy during the Oslo era, or the period that Oslo was in favor, ignored was the shifting sands in the international arena. We could start first with Russia. Russia in 1998 received a new foreign minister, Gennady Primakov. Primakov was the person responsible for, despite his Jewish origins, Primakov was responsible for Middle Eastern affairs under the old management, under the communist regime. Primakov was no idiot, but Primakov basically said that with, again, what was precisely regarded as evidence of irreversible forces, the expansion of NATO to Eastern Europe, that Russia had to reassert itself. Obviously, it was too weak still to reassert itself fully, but it had every interest in reasserting itself precisely in those regions where the Soviet Union had major interests. For example, Syria, a policy that continues to this day, where the Soviet Union, Russia, even though Putin wants us to go back to the USSR, Russia should assert itself in Syria, in Libya, in countries where it had once had roots with the Soviet Union and which had an interest in resisting this unipolarism. And Russia also had an interest in improving ties with other countries interested in resisting the unipolarism, namely China. China has traditionally followed a policy of allying with the weaker power against a dominant power. So when the People's Republic of China first arose in 1949, the United States was considered the preeminent power, an alliance with the Soviet Union. When China felt that the new hegemonists were the Soviets, this helped pave the way first for a relationship with the middle powers, namely France, with the opening of diplomatic relations in 64, followed by the rapprochement with the United States and with China pressing the United States to take a more assertive policy towards the Soviet Union. And now, these same factors with the peaceful rising more or less accomplished, China began to reassert itself against a unipolar order and an attempt to impose its values, impose other values on a Chinese regime, which believed that only an authoritarian regime could maintain order in China and avoid a retrogression to the days of the Cultural Revolution and internal disorder and perhaps disintegration. So already towards the end of the Also decade, things were shifting. Now, Europe basically was still clinging to the idea that it could impose its own order, but it was already backsliding. We could see it in terms of the relationship between Russia and Germany under Helmut Schroeder. Europe, which had so strongly pressed for democratic values, had so strongly pressed for extending these democratic values, now began to practice a self-censorship in everything that concerned the retrogression of Russia back into authoritarianism and the turning of the censorship of the press, the Khodorkovsky affair, and the elections that resulted in the more remote districts. It was still embarrassing to do this in St. Petersburg or in Moscow, with some precincts, over-enthusiastic precincts, reporting 110% of the vote for United Russia. But this was not just towards Russia. And Professor Cutler mentioned Libya among countries that should have been in the dock of the UN Human Relations Human Rights Commission. We now know that Libya, not just the European Union, could play the soft power game. Authoritarian regimes learned how to play soft power. Respected academics, such as Anthony Giddings, were imported to Benghazi to hold a intellectual dialogue in Muammar Gaddafi's tent, where they came out with glowing reports about the progressive tendencies of the Libyan regime, and one could even expedite a doctorate for the weekend's newest Libyan prisoner, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, direct from the London School of Economics, something which helped with the expansion committee of the school. And something which I would contend also helped the campaign that Professor Cutler spoke about earlier. There's Kemach and there is Torah. And certain regimes did supply Kemach. There were the Arab studies programs on the campuses which necessitated a reply in terms of Israeli studies programs. So the idea that the good guys would always control the soft power, that assumption was proven wanting. And Israel learned the lesson of the weakening of the 1990s system in terms of its operation in Lebanon and Operation Cast Lead, which brought about the Goldstone Report. An assumption by Oslo and those who effectively followed it, like Ehud Olmert, if Israel plays by these rules, the gamble may fail, but at least there would be an international arena that would allow Israel freedom of action if the gamble failed. You had the withdrawal from Lebanon. You had, I don't like to use the term disengagement, I would still prefer to use the expulsion from Gaza, but let's use disengagement and expulsion interchangeably. The basic fallback argument of the Oslo advocates that we now had a congenial international arena that could safeguard Israel in case a gamble was proven wrong. This proposition was now placed severely in doubt. And I'd like to conclude again by parasitically attaching myself to Professor Cutler's, I think, concluding remarks that we should couch Israel's case in terms of the international ramifications. And here, let me respectfully express a bit of pessimism, precisely by using the example of Iran. Again, despite Israel's Oslo policy, there is little inclination to stop Iran from getting the bomb. For China, Iran is a supplier of energy. For Russia, it provides a sort of kashrut certificate against Islamic forces within Russia, allows Russia a sort of kashrut certificate in Chechnya. The European Union conducted for years a constructive dialogue with Iran, and even the United States, even a Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, who has stated openly that Iran is killing American soldiers or contributing to their deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan, shows no inclination, I hope I'm proven wrong, at least up to now, there is no inclination of the United States to take serious actions, even to take more serious economic actions against Iran, because of fears that an already troubled American economy can be even more discomfited. I need not go into details about Europe's position, where Europe is seeking people who will assume its debt, whether in Moscow, whether in Beijing, how much soft power the European Union can wield. So in summation, I'm saying that while I strongly disagreed with Oslo, there were international developments that seemed to give it a chance for success, or at least safeguard Israel in case it had proven a failure. That and events in the Arab world show that, and here I will perhaps return to my more partisan position, Israel has to take for itself security margins because it cannot rely on the fact that either its immediate neighborhoods or the broader international neighborhood will remain the same forever. Thank you.